This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. The National Commission on the Future of the Army issued a report last week on the recruiting pool for the military, and the picture doesn't look good. They say the number of recruitment-age youths is shrinking, and among that group, the number of young people eligible for the military is even smaller because so many of them are too uneducated or just out of shape. We're going to talk about the effect this might have on the readiness of the U.S. military. Last year, undercover videos exposed Planned Parenthood for illegally trafficking fetal tissue from aborted babies, a very gruesome story. Well, last week, a grand jury in Houston handed down indictments in the case, but not against Planned Parenthood. They actually protected the abortion-providing institution, and they went after the man who shot the videos of what they were doing. The Trumpet staff is starting a new project called Imperial Academy Bible Lessons. This is a kindergarten through ninth grade program that produces monthly lessons intended to acquaint young people with their Bibles and to teach them just basic lessons in life from the Bible. We're going to talk with a couple of staff members who are working on this project, a very exciting project. And one of them is the Trumpet's newly hired writer, Andrew Miller. We're going to conclude the program with a few words about the nature of real freedom and what Almanza Wilder would think if he could see the world today. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The top-selling video game of 2015 was called Call of Duty Black Ops 3. This is a military first-person shooter game. It's the 12th game in the Call of Duty series. It was released 2 months ago in November. This video game made $550 million in its first 3 days of release, over $500 million. That's about double what Star Wars The Force Awakens made in its opening weekend, which set all records for movie box office gross. Supposedly, this game is played only by people who are over 17 years old. This game allows players to control soldiers from a first-person point of view as they go around killing people. The ESRB rated it mature for, quote, blood and gore, drug references, intense violence, strong language. The ESRB rating says players use machine guns, pistols, shotguns, grenade launchers. Action is frenetic with frequent gunfire, explosions, cries of pain, blood splatter effects. Some attacks allow players to blow up enemies or blow off their arms or legs. A handful of cutscenes depict figures being beaten, tortured, or stabbed. Some stabbings are depicted fairly close up, and so on and so forth. There's a whole lot of people, $550 billion worth, who are fantasizing about being part of the elite forces in the U.S. military. Now, in related news, the actual U.S. military has a problem. They have a soft recruiting pool. There are a lot of young people who are simply unfit for the job. Congress charged a group called the National Commission on the Future of the Army to look at the Army's structure. And last Thursday, January 28th, this commission released its final report. And in the report, the commission warned of a small pool of talent. They said it is likely to shrink even more, leading to potential future challenges for military recruiting. The commission noted that the projected decline in the recruiting eligible population is particularly concerning given that less than half of the military age population is eligible for military service due to physical, educational, or behavioral fitness, for example, having criminal records. And these, I'm reading some quotes from a report by missionreadiness.org. This is an organization of retired generals and admirals that supports investments in America's children in order to help ensure that they're going to be ready to fulfill their duties as citizens. And this is a section from this congressional report. Only 0.7% of the U.S. population served in one of the nation's armed forces in 2015. This is a small pool of talent, and it is likely to shrink even more. And this isn't even speaking of cuts in military funding, reductions in military staffing. This is just talking about, do we have the people who would be able to fulfill these jobs if we make them available? The report says current U.S. population projections indicate potential future challenges for military recruiting. They talk about the fact that military age population is declining, and then fewer and fewer of those in that demographic are fit for the military. Increased disqualifications for health, the report says, will overwhelm small improvements in educational attainment and aptitude. This is the big problem, is that young people just are not healthy. The military's recent decision to allow women into all combat roles may slightly increase the eligible population, but women might not voluntarily join direct combat career fields in overly large numbers. That seems like a reasonable assumption to make. The military could relax some criteria, for example, tattoo restrictions or body piercings. There's something about body piercings in a soldier that seems a little bit odd to me, but without harming the quality of recruited personnel. But significant changes in the standards for physical fitness will likely result in a less capable force. This is common sense, isn't it? That if you lower the standard for physical fitness, that your soldiers aren't going to be as capable. But essentially, in order to get the numbers, that's what they're having to contemplate, because there are so few young people who are actually able to meet those physical standards. The report continues, the Army will continue to have the most difficult recruiting challenge within the Department of Defense based on the volume of enlistments needed and public perceptions concerning risk to the force. The nation's Army is recruited from the society it serves. So this is a reflection of America today and the state of our young people. The educational capabilities, their fitness as citizens, their ability to avoid committing crimes, and most immediately, just their physical fitness. The Mission Readiness website says this, currently more than 70% of 17 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. cannot serve in the military. More than 7 in 10 cannot serve, primarily because they are too poorly educated, too overweight, or have a serious criminal record. So again, they're talking about failing to meet the baseline requirements in education and physical fitness to even go to boot camp. We're not even talking about reaching a battlefield. We're not talking about actually being able to perform military duties. We're talking about just getting in the door. There's something very concerning and very shameful about what this report says. I think it does show that a loss of manliness in America, and that's going to have real consequences. As the world grows more dangerous, the need for a fit, manly military is great. The need for troops in the world today, it's very strong. And the military, in order to make sure that they have enough people coming in, they have to increase their incentives. They have to increase the pay. They have to make the accommodations more comfortable. They increase the privacy and bonuses. They make entrance easier for recruits. So more and more people are going into the military because of what's in it for them. They're not there to answer the call of duty. They're there to pay the bills. They're there to, you know, be all that they can be, and that type of thing. And the military is dropping recruitment standards. Their goal, the Army's goal, is for 90% of its recruits to be high school graduates, but they have settled for around 70%. And making matters worse, the Armed Forces Qualification Test, this is the test that determines basic math and reading skills, they flunked 30% of the recruits who had a high school degree. These are the ones that that actually made that requirement, but they weren't actually able to do the math and reading at the level that the military required. Now, once recruits are in, they still have a long way to go before they're ready to serve. 20% of those with a diploma drop out of their first term of enlistment. That's usually 3 years. Half of those with a GED drop out, which really suggests that they don't have the discipline, or they don't have the intelligence, they don't have the physique. Something is preventing them from being able to actually serve. In boot camp, they have, the boot camp is obviously typically a place of intense pressure, a lot of physical exertion, and trying to harden the recruits mentally, preparing them for the rigors of combat. Well, boot camp isn't what it used to be. In the last 10 years, they've actually changed the experience considerably. In 2005, instructors were ordered to yell less, to lighten up on the pressure on recruits. Instead of saying, you meet the requirements or you get out, they're told to mentor them, to help them, to really reach out to the ones who are struggling. Not to mention that they have, boot camp videos that they offer to recruits who go through there so that they can have a commemorative video of their experience. Drill sergeants can no longer expel people just because they say they don't measure up in their discipline or their moral qualities. You have to ask, if young people can't complete the tasks under a screaming drill sergeant, how are they going to do when it's bullets that are screaming past them? Privates at basic combat training are given more sleep, more personal time, more food, more dessert. Their stress is minimized. The amount of running that privates have to do has been reduced substantially. And since more and more recruits haven't experienced physical education or sports, they're trying to help these recruits avoid injuries by replacing some of the running in boot camp with stretching. So many soldiers have become overweight. We have this idea of the strong, robust warrior, but what we have instead is we have that image maybe on Call to Duty Black Ops 3. That's what it looks like on the video game screen, but it's not necessarily there in reality. It just makes you wonder. I mean, this is definitely, as that report said, what's happening in the military is a reflection of society, and the recruiting pool they have to draw from is society at large. And what are our young people doing? What are our boys doing? What are our young men doing? Are they hiking trails? Are they riding bikes? Are they swimming rivers or climbing trees or exploring in the woods? Are they jumping off of sand piles? More and more, they're just controlling a video game character who might be doing those things. They're not investigating the great outdoors, looking at wildlife, crafting things. They're not reading high-quality books. They're not developing social skills. They're not developing respect for authority or self-discipline or decisiveness. They're not, on the whole, being taught values like hard work, physical, mental, emotional strength. These just are not broadly taught. There is a prophecy in Isaiah 3, and we refer to it with some regularity on Trumpet Radio. But it foretells what we see happening in the military in the United States today. And this is not at all to disparage those soldiers. There still are a great many soldiers of high character and who I think probably would be more frustrated by this state of affairs than anyone because they're directly affected by it in their daily jobs. But this passage in Isaiah 3 describes the modern nations of Israel being stripped of the mighty man, stripped of the man of war, the captain of 50, these strong, valiant champions. Leviticus 26, verse 19 says, I will break the pride of your power. The next verse says, your strength shall be spent in vain. The prophet Ezekiel foretold a time when the trumpet of war would be blown and none would go to the battle. So we do have in this country unmatched military spending. There's just a tremendous amount of money going into the military and a lot of effort to make it the best military that it can be, but that cannot compensate for a society that is being swallowed up in selfishness, in immorality, in weakness. And you add to that the terrible foreign policy decisions coming out of the White House, things that are weakening America's position abroad, and other factors like the potential for cyber attacks that cripple high-tech weapon systems. It's not difficult to see that what appears to be the greatest military in the world could end up shockingly vulnerable to attack. And in addition to those prophecies that I just mentioned, there are prophecies, frightening prophecies, of America's impending social collapse and defeat. So we do see current events pointing to the fulfillment of those prophecies, which it's difficult to watch in one sense, but it's also amazing to see the Bible shown accurate, proven to be true. But I just want to close this segment with this poem from Josiah Gilbert Holland. He wrote this: God, give us men. A time like this demands strong minds, great hearts, true faith, and ready hands. Men whom the lust of office does not kill. Men whom the spoils of office cannot buy. Men who possess opinions and a will. Men who have honor. Men who will not lie. Men who can stand before a demagogue and damn his treacherous flatteries without winking. Tall men, sun-crowned, who live above the fog in public duty and in private thinking. For while the rabble, with their thumb-worn creeds, their large professions and their little deeds, mingle in selfish strife, lo, freedom weeps, wrong rules the land, and waiting justice sleeps.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Last year, you'll remember Planned Parenthood was exposed in a series of undercover videos showing officials of that organization trafficking aborted baby body parts. This is one of the most horrifying stories you can imagine. There was a lot of outrage about this and people realizing what this organization was up to. This is a major source of revenue for this company, this government-funded company. Well, last week, indictments were handed down in this terrible case, but you're not going to believe who was indicted. It wasn't Planned Parenthood officials who were having these conversations about selling the body parts of the babies that they abort. It wasn't about their operating on the black market. That's not who was convicted. The grand jury in Houston that was studying into this cleared Planned Parenthood of illegally selling fetal tissue, but they indicted the man who shot the videos exposing what they were doing. We have Dennis Leap here to talk about this. He wrote an article last year, Trafficking Aborted Baby Body Parts, for the Trumpet magazine. You can actually find that online at thetrumpet.com. He's been following the story ever since. Hello, Dennis.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So tell us, first of all, what this grand jury decided in this case.
It is kind of interesting. If you go back to the history, one of the films that Center for Medical Progress, or David DeLeiden, who's the head of that organization, they did show a film from Houston. It was from the Planned Parenthood, I think it's called Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast. And that video was so disturbing that the governor, I think it's Greg Abbott, and his lieutenant governor, they requested this probe immediately into what was happening down there in the Houston area. And of course, you have to understand there's been investigations done all over the country with this. It's not just Houston. And so
which is a natural thing to do. I mean, the allegations and what was exposed in those videos was absolutely horrifying and demanded someone look into this more deeply. These individuals who were involved, these were high-profile Planned Parenthood officials who were having these conversations with these individuals. Just chilling, chilling stuff.
It's absolutely horrendous. It's they're nightmarish to watch. I've watched almost all of them.
You have a thicker stomach than I have.
They are just really gut wrenching. But the thing is it's just unbelievable how when this all happened and it all hit the news. Then of course Planned Parenthood went into this super media operation to, you know, say that DeLayden's a liar, saying that DeLayden has, heavily manipulated the films to look like these things are happening, when really you can look at all of the films. There's nothing been actually cut. I mean, the films were cut down to be shorter versions that they offered. But if you look, you can go onto his website and look at the whole film, and you literally see the heads of these organizations talking about this as if it's nothing. And right. they're having lunch. Of course, it's David DeLayden and his actors, and they're having lunch with them, but they're discussing how they can manipulate abortions. They're discussing how they can get the fetuses into the right position so they can save the heads and they can save the kidneys and the livers and all that. And it's just absolutely horrendous.
And a huge profit stream for this organization. As far as this was one of the aspects of the story when you were reporting this last year, that it just makes it as bad as it can be, the fact that they're making so much money off of this, and they really are manipulating these processes in order to maximize their bottom line.
Yes. And the one official even made a joke about it. She says, well, I guess maybe I could buy a Lamborghini. You don't prompt people to say those things. You don't edit those things into a video. And I think the thing that's also good to remember is, like for David DeLayden and his associates, this isn't the first sting. This isn't the first investigation of the sale of body parts. There was one previously done, 10 years ago. They were talking about the sale of body parts and fetal tissues and all that. So this isn't the first time this has ever gone on.
Now, he went to some pretty extreme lengths to put himself in a position masquerading as a potential buyer, setting up front companies and doing things just in order to have these basically frank discussions with these Planned Parenthood officials.
Yes, he did. But that's nothing different than what the FBI does. That's nothing different than what, other government agencies do. I mean,
if we have a sense of proportion, I mean, the outrage has to be directed against the real crime that's taking place here. If we have any sense of proportion, we know what the real problem is here.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And so then what you have now is you have in Harris County, Texas, you have a DA that was doing this investigation into this Planned Parenthood local organization, and essentially what they did is what she did is she turned the tables and actually went after now the people that are doing the film, that did the films. And what they've gone after him for is they've indicted him on a felony charge of tampering with a government record. And what that means is when they came into Houston and they came into the clinic to show an ID to get permission to go inside, they showed a false California driver's license. So they're saying that's, this horrible crime. And they charged him with a felony, and he could get 20 years if they would find him guilty for that. And then they
In other words, this is the same thing that an underage kid would do to get alcohol.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But it's, like I said, it's nothing that, I mean, the FBI, your spy agencies, they do this all the time. Even to do the drug stings that we have, even to do to catch pedophiles, they'll do the same thing. These are, police organizations that do this. And so other journalists have done this, and David DeLayden is a journalist, and he's trying to exercise his right to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And essentially what they want to do is squash it. So the second thing that they did indict him for, and it's also, he's got an associate, her name is Sandra Merritt. And so they're indicting her for the same thing, for using a false government record. But they also now have indicted them for trying to purchase body parts. And part of the sting was they did set up the organization that they were a scientific organization that was out looking for body parts. And so in the film, and then also through emails after the film was made, they did request buying body parts, and how much would they would ask questions like, how much would you pay for it? Well, according to Texas state law, to even request to buy a body part is illegal. And so essentially what the district attorney did is she turned the tables and said, well, now we're going to indict him for trying to sell body parts. And it's illegal, or trying to buy body parts, either buying or selling. But it's illegal to even request it, whether he intended to do it or not. That's according to Texas state law. So, I mean, everybody that's seen these films know that David DeLeiden has no intention to buy any body part. Mm-hmm. You know, what he's trying to do is he's trying to expose the absolute manipulation of other governmental laws. I mean, abortion in itself is a horrible crime. It is legal in the United States. But there are even laws that govern how you provide the abortion. And you are not permitted to manipulate a fetus in order, in other words, you know, partial birth abortions are illegal in this country. But essentially what the Planned Parenthood officials are saying, yes, well, we can manipulate this or we can manipulate that, so that, in other words, the fetus doesn't come out all cut up. Mm-hmm. And so really that's the great crime.
So in other words, there is just the moral outrage involved in what the Planned Parenthood officials were doing, but there's also just legal statutes on the books that they were breaking in order to be able to run this operation the way they were.
Now, whether they knew it or not, I mean, I think every state probably has some specific writings in their laws. I don't know if, I mean, I have never talked to David DeLeiden myself. I haven't talked to any of his associates directly. Whether they knew it or not, it just seems like to me what's happening is, even down in Harris County, there is this history of what they would call cronyism inside the DA's office. Now, I don't want to cast any bad light on Miss Anderson's character. I know her husband died, and she took over for him, and then she was elected. But there are some facts coming out that she is very good friends with a pro-abortionist down there. And I mean, the thing is it just looks like what's gone on is there could be some effort to say, look, let's throw out these indictments, let's throw out these charges, you know, let's make this look really bad. Just let Planned Parenthood alone, you know, mm-hmm. back off of this. It's almost like it's all a scare tactic. If you look at Fox News, I think it's Judge
Napolitano.
Napolitano said this is nothing more than, it's just like a political gunshot to shut DeLeiden up, or to shut up the Center for Medical Progress.
Like actually saying that this indictment isn't going to stand. Is that right?
Right. He feels that it will not. I mean, we don't know exactly what's being said, because with grand juries, they do not necessarily make it public record until it's all filed. Mm-hmm. So we really don't even know what they're saying in it yet. But he said it's unlikely that any of this is going to hold up in court.
So what we're looking at is essentially this DA was making a statement and standing up in defense of Planned Parenthood and saying, look, if you want to talk about legalities, we're going to come after you with everything that we've got in our arsenal. But doesn't this show the state of the legal system and some individuals in that system, that they're willing to kind of use whatever means they have at their disposal, irregardless of right and wrong, of moral considerations, of any sense of balance and true justice, any sense of actually pursuing the truth? They're willing to kind of use whatever means that they have at their disposal to try to bring someone down Just because they think it's right. It's not a matter of exercising the law the way that it's meant to be exercised. It's whatever they think, and they're going to stand up and do what they can about it.
That's exactly right. It's kind of crazy. Doing a little bit of research on our office. There was a whole furor recently over, you know, abuse of animals, and her office was being criticized for not standing up for abused animals, you know, abused dogs. There was so here, if you look at is exactly what you're saying, if you look at it here, this clinic, Planned Parenthood, Gulf Coast, you know, they're running abortions. We forget the fact that this is killing babies. And so if someone is coming in to expose that and to show that there is this illegality going on of selling their body parts, then, I mean, it makes us look like Nazi criminals, if you really think about it. You know, taking, it's like some of the medical experiments they did. Mm-hmm. And then now you're taking these body parts and you're selling them. And so what we do sometimes with our law is we go after the guy that's trying to solve the problem instead of solving the problem. And of course, you know, you don't know the whole story, but here you have a woman district attorney who's obviously going to stand up for women's rights. And you have Planned Parenthood. That's their concern all the time. We have to preserve women's rights, to preserve their health and to make their choices. But what Daladin and his organization and other organizations like him, he's got a lot of support, they're saying is, where's the real crime?
Right.
The real crime is killing babies.
It couldn't look any worse. Yeah. I mean, we'll learn more about it. You're working on this story, putting together an article for thetrumpet.com. But yeah, everything just in the initial stages of what we've learned about this, it really seems like a stunning indictment against America, America's criminal justice system, and so many aspects of moral life in the United States. So we do look forward to reading the article about that. Listeners can watch for that in the next few days on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Dennis.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Trumpet Staff has a new writer, Andrew Miller. Andrew is here with me today. How are you, Andrew?
Doing well.
This is Andrew's first full week in the office, and he wasn't hired only to write for The Trumpet. He's also going to help us with an exciting new project, the Imperial Academy Bible Lessons. Imperial Academy is the private K-12 school that we have on the Philadelphia Church of God campus, where The Trumpet and Trumpet Hour are produced. And this Bible Lesson series is a project intended to help young people get to know their Bibles. Andrew's been working on the first several lessons already, and now he's hard at work on the remaining lessons that we want to get out here shortly. We also have Philip Nice here, who is editing and assisting with these lessons. Hello, Phil.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Andrew, tell us, first of all, what are Imperial Academy Bible Lessons?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this project. These are... actually, they're for our K-12 school, but they're actually a K-9 curriculum for our Bible class at the Imperial Academy, which we'll be also be sending out like a type of correspondence course. It just comes about 13 lessons a year in about a 10-page format that comes in. And they start out in the K level, very just basic. Foundational biblical instruction for children, Adam and Eve, the two trees, Noah and the ark, Cain and Abel, Abraham, and the spiritual and moral lessons we can take from those stories. But as they progress into the higher levels, they really are quite unique in that they teach children how to study the Bible for themselves. It's not just like listening to like your typical Sunday school program. They've got fill in the blanks to where you'll look up the scriptures that they reference and fill in the words that aren't included in the text of the lessons, just to really teach them to not just believe everything they're here, but really prove everything for themselves from the Bible.
That's one of the aspects of the correspondence course, which we also offer, the Herbert W. Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, which is so powerful, actually encouraging people to blow the dust off the Bible, pull it out, open it up, and study it for themselves and answer the questions. And there is a certain element to that, even in in the what grade seven and up, or is it even earlier than that?
I just finished the grade seven, the first two drafts of grade seven, so I know it's definitely in that. And I believe I'd have to double check, but I believe even as early as like fifth or sixth grade, they start in with the scripture fill in the blank.
Look it up and fill it in yourself and check to see that what we're teaching is actually there in the Bible.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're actually quite, they do look quite similar for anyone who's familiar with the Herbert W. Armstrong College Correspondence Course. They're about the same size, since they're for a younger audience. There are a few less pages and a few less scriptures, of course, and the information's more basic. But they had a similar product years ago in the Worldwide Church of God, and I actually knew a man who, for his daughter, had started them out kindergarten level, doing one of these youth Bible lessons a month. And then by the time they finished the first 9 years, they just transitioned actually very seamlessly into the correspondence course. And then if you do one of those a month, it takes about 3 years. So they completed both between age
by the time they graduated
high school graduation.
Yeah, very cool. So what are the subjects that we cover? I know that as we're going through these levels, you're going level one, level two. With each grade, you're progressing up one level in these. That there is a certain amount of overlap. What are the subjects that are covered generally in these lessons? Actually, Andrew, maybe you could just tell us what subjects are covered in the lessons.
Yeah, well, they start out at the kindergarten level with like the creation of the world, very like Book of Genesis, very beginning, and they go out through, I think that throughout the course of that year goes pretty much through just the Book of Genesis. Then the next year they get to second grade, you cover the Book of Genesis a little more quickly, not quite, well, actually they're longer, so it's actually even more detail as you're getting up in grade. But then they also cover like Exodus and Judges. And then the next grade, you'll probably get like Genesis, Exodus, Judges, even into like 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. And it progresses on to where by the time you get to 7th grade, you actually cover the entire Old Testament in a year. And there, some of the information that's been covered in previous years is abbreviated a little bit if you've already gone over that, but the lessons get longer, as I think the kindergarten grade, you only have like 200 or 300 word lessons, to whereby you get to like 7th grade, you're looking like it's like a 6,000 word lesson to cover all the material. And then after 7th grade, you're getting into like late middle school, early high school. For 8th and 9th grade, they actually cover New Testament topics.
So by the time people have finished all nine levels, they've actually got a pretty good overview of the entire Bible and quite a lot of repetition and just really locking down a firm foundation on some of those foundational lessons from the Old Testament, particularly in the Book of Genesis, which kind of establishes the foundation for the entire Bible.
Yes, that's definitely true, because there's a lot of repetition for Genesis, which is a very foundational book, and then they will go through like pretty much the whole Bible, Genesis to Revelation, by the time you're done with it. And I think even like in the 5th, 6th grades, there's even some like special lessons that cover parts of the Bible that aren't necessarily history. They do cover the whole Old Testament history, but they do have a couple special lessons devoted on like the prophecies, some of the minor, I mean, I guess it's history as well, because they were made by some of the major and minor prophets, that is part of the study of the Old Testament, but it will tie in very closely to modern events, even for middle schoolers to understand that.
So I've read the first lesson. I've read lesson one of the three levels that we're working on right now, level one, level four, and level seven. And I got to say that I think they're absolutely fantastic. Like, I've really enjoyed going through these. Philip, maybe you can talk a little bit about how do you bring these biblical lessons to life for young people? How do you speak to them in a way that really will make them excited about this material?
Well, it really derives from the material itself. Andrew drafts the lessons, and then I go through them. So he's got the basis there that comes from the Bible itself. As he said, the student has to open the Bible and match what is being said in the lesson to what's literally printed there in the Bible. And I find it to be just a very clarifying process, because I do other editing as well for more adult level readers. But when you're editing for a child or like a young child even, it's surprising the burden of proof that is on you. It's actually, in some ways, it's not easier than editing, say, like a trumpet article or something like that. It's, you know how children can be. They ask why. They ask,
right.
You know, if this, then why that? Or if that, then why this? And so it's actually been a powerful exercise in logic. You know, why do we believe this? Why do we say this? You know, is this doctrine or this teaching from the Bible that I've believed and I believe, how well does it stand up? You know, can I explain it? And
does it pass the fourth grader smell test?
Exactly. does it pass the fourth grade inquisitive mind test?
Yeah. Well, that's good. So you're mostly looking at this just from a clarity of logic standpoint, you know, following point by point. And if the idea is we want them to be able to prove this for themselves, then we've got to make sure that what we're saying stands up to scrutiny.
That's right. And these level ones, or these lesson ones, on these three levels that we're working on, they all start at the beginning. And they start at the beginning of the Bible and the beginning of mankind, Adam and Eve, and even before Adam and Eve. And so there is important, crucial stuff in these lessons, and
right.
It's not just the story of, you know, Adam and Eve, and it's strange
and then this
that
happened,
they were naked
and happened,
in a garden,
and,
this, yeah. and you know, just kind of these weird fable-like stories. Not weird, but, you know, interesting Old Testament fables. It's so much more than that. It really happened, and it's recorded and been preserved at great effort for centuries and millennia for us as adults to know, but also for children to get that lesson in mind right from an early age, the lesson of the two trees. And there's so much there. And so you take that and you try to boil it down to its essentials and say it in short sentences, short, simple words.
Right.
And as I said, it's a powerful exercise to do that even as an adult. And I think even for parents who are reading these to their children, I mean, as I've been editing these, I've been thinking about reading them to my daughter. And I have gotten very excited at how we can take these concepts that are going to affect her for the rest of her life, starting at age two or mm-hmm. age three. She's going to be learning about the just basic difference between, you know, doing your will or doing God's will.
Right.
Something yeah. like that.
Andrew and I were talking yesterday about just the whole lesson with Jacob and Esau, and the lesson in the fact that Esau sold his birthright for this bowl of pottage. And there's some information in there. There's a paragraph about how easy it is to prioritize the immediate for over what is lasting and what really has value. And it's just really eloquently put. This is in the grade 7 lesson 1. But such a powerful lesson for a 13-year-old to start thinking about, well, how do I make sure that I'm putting the long-term view over whatever might seem most important at the moment, or what's going to satisfy my senses right at the moment. So, Andrew, you mentioned before about just how this does have a predecessor. There's a blueprint that we followed. We're writing all of this. It's all original stuff, but we're following the blueprint that Herbert W. Armstrong established in the Worldwide Church of God. Talk for a little bit just about the YES lessons.
Right. They called it, yeah, I guess it's Youth Educational Services, or YES. Mr. Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God, he green-lighted that project starting about 1980. And then they produced those lessons right up till just after his death in 1986. So they produced 9 levels between 1980 and 1987. that were used by the members. I went through them.
You went through them, Phil. I went through them.
Yes.
So you get these lessons every month. It's kind of exciting. I know every year, you know, you get the new level, and it was a new color, and there were pictures in this one, and the print was a little bit smaller. There was more detail, and it was kind of exciting. And then you'd go to church services and have your interaction with one of the adults in the congregation. And you want to talk about that a little bit, Phil?
I remember going through those lessons, and I really remember the illustrations. Mm. And to me, it's very exciting and a relief that we have some top-notch illustrators working on the Imperial Academy Bible lessons, because when I think of Esau, I think of that bearded picture of Esau from the YES lessons.
Yeah.
And so I just really enjoy the illustrations, and that might seem like a small thing, but the interactivity of coloring, you know, and at the younger ages, coloring those illustrations and the interactive puzzles and things like that. They're very simple interactivity, but I remember those lessons to this day.
Yeah. So the master plan that we have here, Andrew, can you just tell us what we're trying to do here?
Right. Some of our production schedule's still being nailed down, but we've already completed the first drafts for the special Spring Holy Day issue.
So a few details yet to work out, but we're working hard on it. Andrew, we appreciate the work that you've done so far. I think it's been outstanding work. I've thoroughly enjoyed reading these lessons. I'm like you, Phil, just thinking about the discussions over the breakfast table and being able to work with my kids with these lessons. And they are going to use it as a partial curriculum, if not the whole curriculum, the Bible curriculum at the Imperial Academy. So a lot of the younger people and our students here at the school, they'll be using these lessons. And hopefully we'll make them available to whoever wants them. We're going to be publicizing more information about it as the lessons are actually printed and we begin to distribute them. So stay tuned to thetrumpet.com, and we'll make them available to you if you're interested. So thanks for coming in, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll have many more conversations about these in the years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for today's Last Word.
In the 1860s, on his family's farm in upstate New York, 9-year-old Almanzo Wilder grows up working. He embraces considerable responsibility, and he yearns for more. When the boy receives an offer of apprenticeship from the owner of the wagon shop in town, Almanzo's father explains to him the benefits of the shop job versus farming. He says it'd be an easier life, shelter from the weather, fewer worries, plenty to eat, money in the bank. But then he says, there's the other side too, Almanzo. You'd have to depend on other folks, son, in town. Everything you got, you'd get from other folks. A farmer depends on himself and the land and the weather. If you're a farmer, you raise what you eat, you raise what you wear, and you keep warm with wood out of your own timber. You work hard, but you work as you please, and no man can tell you to go or come. You'll be free and independent, son, on a farm. Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote that in her biographical book, Farmer Boy. It's amazing how foreign, how remote that is from life today. There was a time in the land of the free when this was freedom. Being free to work, free to provide for your family, free from dependence on others. Today, freedom has come to mean nearly the opposite of that. People want freedom from responsibility, freedom from consequences for inaction and failure, freedom from having to work, provide, contribute, give, or serve. A 9-year-old is way ahead if he's responsible enough to make his own bed. And the Wagon Shop Apprentice is among the most self-sustaining among us. Folks in town who make things that people need are the least dependent. They're generating wealth in the private sector. Beside them, America has millions of people on federal, state, and local government payrolls, comprising the biggest sector of the national economy. Millions more are even more dependent, living on handouts from government social programs, welfare, nationalized retirement funds, healthcare entitlements. Even our once free and independent farmers live off federal subsidies. America is going the direction of Europe, where the millstone of socialist entitlements is even heavier. And evidence shows these programs create as many problems as they purport to solve. Misguided welfare policies reward single mothers more than intact families. And since they subsidize it, they get more of it. Britain's welfare system has created a surge in broken homes. Britain pays 2.6 million people for being sick and incapable. Over 500,000 of them are thought to be able to work but are unwilling. 100,000 on sick benefit are between ages 16 and 24, and three-fourths of these youngsters are suspected of faking their sicknesses. One in five of them has been receiving this money for at least 5 years. It shouldn't surprise us that the nation is also suffering an exploding epidemic of 16 to 24-year-olds who aren't going to school and aren't working, and a simultaneous epidemic of youth antisocial and even criminal behavior. Almanzo Wilder, if he could have paused from his work and peered into this future, would have been incredulous. Government tends to create dependence in order to justify and amplify its own existence. It promises the kind of freedoms Anglo-Americans have come to crave, freedom from responsibility, from work, from consequences. But the more we depend on government, the more we surrender our actual freedom and compromise our character and shrink within the confines of childhood. This is one reason we have legions of grown men less capable, trustworthy, and productive than the 9-year-old farmer boys of yesteryear. We've come to promote and believe a pack of lies, that honest work is a curse and idleness a blessing, that happiness comes from materialism, that luxuries are a birthright, that redistributing wealth is only fair, and that it's more blessed to receive than to give. Do you realize one in five Americans say that the most practical way to amass wealth and the best hope of financial security is not to work hard or save or invest soundly or contribute a useful product or service to society, but to win the lottery? One in five, and among those who make less than $25,000 a year, it's two in five. Now that's absolute nonsense. Don't believe the propaganda that life gets only better when it gets easier. Go back to the Bible-based wisdom that helped build our nation. Give honest labor for honest wages. Turn down unnecessary handouts. Shun get-rich-quick schemes. Control materialism and covetousness within yourself. Live within your means. Apply yourself, be diligent and industrious, conduct your business in a principled way, fair transactions that benefit both buyer and seller. Take responsibility for your own. Make God your partner, obey his laws, give him his tithe. This is the most practical way to build wealth. This is the best hope of financial security. Follow this wisdom, and you'll enjoy a considerable measure of actual freedom. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Dennis Leep, Philip Nice, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from John Stuart Mill. The person who has nothing for which he is willing to fight, nothing which is more important than his own personal safety, is a miserable creature and has no chance of being free unless made and kept so by the exertions of men better than himself. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.